Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al Fayed, Predator at Harrods.
Cash, with that you can control people.
Nothing comes for free.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from our studios in central London. I'm Julian Marshall. The Israel Defence Forces today renewed their evacuation orders for Palestinians living in the decimated northern half of Gaza, although residents say that the fighting and Israeli sniping are making it impossible to leave. The Israeli military began its latest offensive in northern Gaza a week ago, centering on the town of Jabalia and nearby refugee camp, the largest in the territory and just north of Gaza City. The military has bombarded Gaza several times over the past year, but has returned because it says Hamas is regrouping in the north. The medical charity MSF says the latest Israeli bombardments are turning some neighbourhoods into uninhabitable ruins. Health officials say that more than 150 people have so far been killed. There's widespread panic among residents, as I heard very clearly from Farida Adel, journalist and English teacher, when I spoke to her a short while ago.
I am from Sheikh Ridwan, specifically from Al-Jala. This is an area related with Jabalia area. Today is extremely difficult. They dropped leaflets for evacuation and tanks have reached a nearby area and we cannot move anywhere now. Danger is everywhere. And the current situation here cannot describable, unbearable. Israel occupation, every horrific thing to let people go out from Jabalia to where we don't know where. I have with me three siblings and my parents. We couldn't move because we don't know where can we go. We are so confused, we are so horrific, and I'm so speechless to describe the current situation. They all people evacuated place to place to find a safe place, but unfortunately, we don't have any kind of safe place because the people who evacuate to other areas, they are targeting from Israel occupation. So what can we do?
So you're saying you've been told to leave your home, but you haven't been told where to go?
Yes, I ask us to leave to the next area. It's called Arimal Street. And I'm so stressed and I'm so confused. I couldn't describe more. They ask us to evacuate other areas, but unfortunately, the old areas now are targeting from them.
You say them, and the Israelis you say are targeting civilians?
Yes, civilians, innocent people, journalists, writers, children, women, displacement people, everything. And I'm so terrified about my family. It's very horrific. I don't know what can we do.
I mean, you mentioned that there were tanks, Israeli tanks, on the streets. Are there Israeli airplanes as well? Israeli soldiers?
Yes.
And these Israeli forces are moving through neighborhoods, are they?
Yes, exactly. They want to invade my area and they step by step invade it.
So you were saying just now you think that the Israelis want to get everyone out of northern Gaza?
Yes, the Israeli tanks are advancing and the soldiers are trying to occupy the entire my area.
Have you been able to take anything with you as you leave your home?
I couldn't hold anything because I'm so terrified. We are just need to save our souls because we are so stressed and we are so fear.
Have you been getting enough food and water?
No, of course, because already we are in hunger. And I have some water and a blanket because it's very cold in the night.
So where will you spend tonight?
Now we are sitting in the back corridor of our neighbor's house, carrying some medicine for my father and for my sister because she injured yesterday.
And you will probably spend the night in this place.
Yes, and we don't feel safe enough to go anywhere or to stay in our because we can evacuate from our place in any moment. So we have to be ready.
That was Farida Adel, journalist and English teacher, speaking from northern Gaza. Well, there are some 400,000 Palestinians living in northern Gaza, according to the United Nations, and they're running short of food, as we'll hear in a moment. But first, our international editor, Jeremy Bowen, reports on the ongoing offensive in the north and a plan devised by retired Israeli generals to force the population there into the south.
We've managed to get to a vantage point overlooking the northernmost parts of northern Gaza. Bet Lachia, Beit Hanun, going down towards Jabalia camp. And in the sort of, I guess, about 10 minutes since we arrived, there's a lot of shelling, airstrikes. I don't know exactly what they are, but it's very intense going on there. There are plumes of smoke going into the air. And even with the naked eye, you can see that the area is absolutely devastated. But Israel has upped the military pressure on northern Gaza once again. Just a few miles away, on the other side of the wall in Gaza, is Jabalia camp, where Palestinian families were fleeing on the orders of the Israeli army. Some of them were hit by bullets.
They told us we have 5 minutes to leave the Fallujah school. Where do we go? In southern Gaza, there are assassinations. In western Gaza, they're shelling people. Where do we go? Oh God, God is our only chance.
Go left and drive slowly down left.
It is really hard to get close to Gaza. Of course, we can't get in there. The Israelis don't allow journalists in, except with the army in very restrictive circumstances. But somehow we've managed to get to the area's checkpoint, which is closed right now in the watchtowers. There are bullet holes. You can see that from, I presume, from October the 7th last year when this area was attacked. We're driving now along the security fence. Barbed wire, chain link fencing, concrete wall in the distance. Now, just probably a mile or so from here, and I know it's about that distance because I've been through so many times into Gaza. It's where there used to be very bustling communities, places now where the Israelis are doing a, by all accounts, major military operation. Of course, they're working in virtual privacy there, secrecy. They're moving, they say, after elements of Hamas, but of course, there are terrible things happening to the civilian population who've already lived under massive pressure for a year.
It's been apparent for some time that this has been a deliberate and systematic attempt to present an existential threat to the Palestinians, particularly in the north of Gaza.
Liz Alcock is head of protection at Medical Aid for Palestinians, and she has just come back from Gaza.
By making life unlivable, but also at the same time, whilst issuing these forced displacement orders, then when people try to flee, the direct targeting of those people whilst they're under the impression that they will be provided safe passage.
What evidence do you have that they're directly targeted? It's a war zone. I mean, there's all sorts of stuff flying around.
When we're receiving patients in hospitals, a large number of those women and children and people of, if you like, non-combatant age, receiving direct shots to the head, to the spine, to the limbs. Very indicative of a direct targeted attack.
At the Kamal Adwan Hospital in northern Gaza, the director, Hossam Abu Safia, is posting daily updates from his intensive care unit. It is filled with wounded children on ventilators. He says Israel is blocking fuel deliveries for his generator and bringing the hospital and its patients close to catastrophe. On Israeli TV, Giora Island, a retired general, launched an idea that he believes can finally deliver victory to Israel and Gaza. It's known as the General's Plan, and there are signs that the Israeli military is implementing at least part of it in northern Gaza. His idea: tell civilians to leave if they don't impose a state of siege, no food or water, and treat everyone left as a legitimate target.
Since we already encircled the northern part of Gaza in the past 9 or 10 months, what we should do is the following thing: to tell all the 300,000 residents that should be given, 10 days to leave through safe corridors that Israel will provide. And after that time, all this area will become to be a military zone. And all the Hamas people, whether some of them are fighters, some of them are civilians, they will have two choices, either to surrender or to starve.
Shalom and welcome to the restoration site of the battles at Yad Mordechai during the Independence War in 1948.
There's an Israeli flag fluttering on the flagpole next to me, and it's over a memorial to a battle when Israelis fought for their independence and the country was invaded by Arab armies. They also fought against Palestinian militias, and the battle here was against an advancing Egyptian army that was trying essentially to destroy the new state at birth. It was a significant battle in what led to Israel's victory, its independence. Palestinians call it the catastrophe. The reason why I'm here is because it's a reminder that all those years after 1948, they're still fighting about who controls this territory effectively. And I can hear airstrikes coming out of Gaza a mile from here. They fought in 1948. They're fighting in 2024. It's a sign of the intractability of this unresolved conflict and a reminder of how it will continue to create and radiate violence until there's some kind of a settlement.
Jeremy Bowen reporting, and later in the programme we'll have a longer interview with the retired Israeli military officer who Jeremy spoke to and who with his colleagues devised the General's Plan. We'll ask him if it is what is being implemented right now in northern Gaza. And a reminder that you can listen to NewsHour whenever you like. We've got two editions a day. You can find the latest online at bbcworldservice.com. Better still, sign up for our free download. Just search for BBC NewsHour podcast. Coming up, a new scam targeting unsuspecting members of Britain's Chinese community.
So when I went straight home, I thought, yeah, let me take out my jewelry. And inside the black bag is just a brick, piece of cake, two bottles of water.
The latest headlines from the BBC newsroom. Alex Salmond, the former First Minister of Scotland, who long led the movement for independence, has died suddenly at the age of 69. The World Food Programme is warning that critical aid hasn't been able to enter the north of the Gaza Strip since the beginning of this month. And Kenya says dozens of its nationals are among thousands of people believed to have been trafficked to Myanmar to work in online fraud centres. This is Julian Marshall with NewsHour live from the BBC in London. Tributes are being paid to Alex Salmond, the former First Minister of Scotland and one of the best-known Scottish nationalists who's died suddenly at the age of 69. It was largely due to his leadership skills that the cause of Scottish independence went from the fringes to the mainstream. Here he is announcing the holding of a referendum on Scottish independence in 2014.
This referendum is about the future of Scotland, and the future of Scotland should be in the hands of the people of Scotland. It's about believing that we can govern ourselves better than anyone else can. We don't need to rise and be a nation again. We only have to vote to believe in ourselves. This is our time, our moment. Let's seize it with both hands.
And although he lost that referendum back in 2014, his legacy is that the idea remains alive. His combative nature saw his fame spread beyond the UK. A dispute with Donald Trump led the former US president to call him Mad Alex. Well, to discuss his political life and legacy, we're joined now by the Scottish journalist and author Leslie Riddick. And Leslie, how did Mr. Salmond make independence such a mainstream issue in Scotland?
Well, because I think he took risks, because he had enormous energy. Just so people understand, there's a devolved parliament in Scotland. It shouldn't be possible for one party to become the outright leader of that parliament. It was designed to create coalitions. And Alex won in 2007, the SNP won, as a minority government. And during that time, boy, did they come out of the stalls quickly. They abolished tuition fees in Scotland. They scrapped prescription charges in Scotland. They invested enormously in renewables, just using planning powers because energy is reserved to Westminster. And they governed. You know, it wasn't just administration, it was real vigorous government. And that led to 2011 when the SNP won on their own. And that probably was what forced the issue then with David Cameron, the UK Prime Minister, that he had to give a referendum to the Scots because the mandate was so strong. So I think that's probably what most people will remember about him, that he was dedicated, passionate, funny as well. And he loved people. He was, I think, almost across Scotland, there'll be so many people tonight that have had individual conversations with Alex because he just loved the heat of battle, exchange, crack, all of it. Okay. And he's dead. It's just really hard to take in.
I've heard him described as a wily political operator. Is that accurate?
Well, yes. He certainly, for example, on that question about renewables, all he had at his disposal was control over planning in Scotland. But using that planning, he invested, he allowed a huge wind and energy industry to develop in Scotland, while south of the border, there was a ban, effectively, on onshore wind. And actually, Scotland didn't have control over energy. So that was kind of wily. And that was the way he would look at a situation and think, OK, walking through the front door, I'm not supposed to be allowed to do that. For example, a week after he won in 2007, he got some guys to go overnight and change the name of the civil service building in Scotland from the Scottish Executive to the Scottish Government. And I think a lot of people would have a little wry smile at that, mm-hmm. because he was just quite cocky in that respect. Of course, that annoyed other people too. And then the country, I suppose, his legacy is that despite everything and despite having no way to have a legal referendum because it's been turned down by both the parties at Westminster, 50% of Scots roughly still support independence.
Leslie, many thanks. Scottish journalist and author Leslie Riddick. Chinese communities around the world are being targeted by a particularly cruel crime known as the blessing scam. Female criminals trick older women out of cash and valuables by persuading them that their loved ones are threatened by evil spirits. In recent months, there have been a wave of cases reported in the US, Canada, Australia, and now, as Elaine Chong reports, in Britain.
The blessing scam is an elaborate piece of criminal street theatre. There's a well-rehearsed script that's acted out for an audience of one, the unsuspecting victim, like Meng Ni in northwest London.
I was on my way going to yoga at the traffic lights on Harrow Road.
One lady just touched my arm and I jumped. And then she spoke in Cantonese.
The Chinese stranger who stopped Meng Ni on a London street introduced herself as Miss Lee. She was crying.
And she says, oh, do you know a Mr. Ko? He's a healer. My husband is very sick and needs his help.
Meng Ni hadn't heard of him, but then a second stranger appeared. She called herself Miss Chan.
Miss Chan said, yeah, I know the way to the healer's home. It's down this way. And she said, you come with me because this lady approached you first.
Meng Ni's yoga plans were abandoned as the women pressured her into going with them. Moments later, they bumped into a third woman who said that she was the healer's granddaughter. After hearing Miss Lee's tale of woe, she disappeared around the corner to seek the healer's help. She returned with troubling news. The healer had apparently discovered that Miss Lee's husband wasn't the only one in danger. Meng Ni was told she had somehow offended an evil spirit, which now threatened her son's life.
He's going to have an accident and he's going to die immediately. I jumped and I was like in tears. You know, how could something like this? So she put the fear in me.
Meng Ni was told that her son could be protected by a blessing. To make it work, she would need to bring valuables for the ritual, but they would be given back to her afterwards.
Just for prayers, for the blessing. So I thought, there's no harm. You know, I'm not going to lose it.
Accompanied by one of the women, she rushed home to collect her jewellery and then to the bank to withdraw more than $5,000. It all went into a black plastic bag over which the healer's relative performed a ceremony in the street. But at some point, the bag was secretly switched for another one, which was handed back to Meng Ni.
So when I went straight home, I thought, yeah, let me take out my jewellery. And inside the black bag is just a brick, piece of cake, 2 bottles of water. And then I just told my son, I said, I think I've been conned, I've been scammed.
If you are struggling to understand how Meng Ni could have been tricked like this and why she placed so much trust in the strangers she had just met, well, so is Meng Ni.
I really cannot tell you why. You know, maybe because they put the fear in me that something is going to happen to my son and all logical thinking got thrown out. Chinese people are a little bit superstitious in some ways.
Meng Ni's story is strikingly similar to those of other victims. Even the fictional healer's name is the same in many cases, and police in the US, Canada and Australia have all recently issued warnings about how the scam works. Anqi Shen is a former Chinese police officer who is now a law professor at Northumbria University in the north of England. She says the criminals know that older Chinese people associate certain valuable items with good fortune, and it's those things which victims are told to bring to be blessed.
Chinese people tend to keep some valuable jewelry, especially pieces made of gold, silver, jade, themselves are believed to hold protective powers. So it is often commonly believed that valuable items which have been blessed offer even greater protection.
Meanwhile, Meng Ni hopes that the law soon catches up with the women who robbed her.
What annoys me a lot as well as these people are conning their own people. And I told the police, I'm willing to do anything to catch these people because these people need to be stopped.
That report by Elaine Chong. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Marshall and this is NewsHour. Do stay with us. We have a lot more to come in the next 30 minutes after a summary of the latest world news.
What are people around the world doing to help tackle the climate emergency?
Climate shocks that we are experiencing.
Droughts, floods, decimated agriculture and so on.
The Climate Question from the BBC World Service looks for answers to those challenges posed by climate change.
How can we solve this?
It's all being discussed.
We only hear the bad stuff in the news, don't we? And there's loads of quiet progress.
Reasons to be hopeful.
Solutions exist. We just need to be able to implement them at scale.
The Climate Question. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
You're with NewsHour. I will spend the rest of my life in prison and die here. There will not be anybody to say goodbye to. All anniversaries will be celebrated without me. I will never see my grandchildren. Well, those prophetic words were written by the Russian dissident Alexei Navalny in March 2022, nearly 2 years before he died in an Arctic penal colony while serving a lengthy prison sentence on charges of extremism. And they're from a memoir which has been published in New York and London 8 months after his death. Natalia Vasilieva is a Russian journalist and former friend of Mr. Navalny. She told me more about the material.
The excerpts that were published this morning actually came from his prison diary, and most of those entries date back to 2022, 2023, when his prison conditions were still not as horrendous as they became later. So lawyers were able to visit him quite frequently, and those pages were smuggled, or not even smuggled, they were passed on to the lawyers, and it was a legal thing to do. There was nothing untoward about it.
And a lot of the entries are very poignant, such as the one that I've just quoted. I mean, they speak of his intense loneliness.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you've said, some of them were quite prophetic. I came across one entry in which he spoke about what might happen when he dies in prison, not actually if he dies, but when he dies. He talks about what happens if prison authorities don't surrender his body to the family. What if he's buried in a marked grave, and how horrific it would be for his family not to know where he will rest and not have a place of burial. And as our listeners might remember, there was quite a bit of a scandal when he died in February, and how long it took for the family to get the body released and to get the authorities permission to bring it back to Moscow and gave him a proper burial. So yeah, it was prophetic in so many ways. It makes quite a chilling read.
Very poignant, very chilling, but also a lot of defiance. And another quote, "The only thing we should fear is that we will surrender our homeland to be plundered by a gang of liars, thieves and hypocrites."
Yeah, I mean, when Navalny came back to Russia in January 2021, he knew he was coming back to a sure imprisonment. He didn't know how it would pan out. He obviously had no idea that Russia would invade Ukraine a year later, and his prison conditions would deteriorate even further. His original arrest sparked nationwide protests, and he was not doing it as a martyr just for the sake of it. He was doing it just to show that in a country ruled by a man without principles, he was the one who had values, and he was actually prepared to sacrifice himself for those values. You know, when you talk about the current Russian leadership, and we're talking about Vladimir Putin, we're in a situation when Russia is in the middle of a war, and it keeps incentivizing Russians to fight in Ukraine by paying out massive bonuses because it is failing to find people to go in Ukraine for free, because obviously no one wants to do it. It's not a righteous war for anyone in Russia.
That was Natalia Vasilieva, a Russian journalist and former friend of the late Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Julian Marshall. The residents of northern Gaza are not just having to contend with continuing Israeli bombardments and the uncertainty of where to flee after receiving evacuation orders, but also growing food shortages. For nearly 2 weeks, the UN's World Food Programme says no food aid has been able to enter northern Gaza, and it's unclear how long existing supplies will last. Antoine Renard is the WFP director for Palestine. He left Gaza on the 8th of October and is currently in Jerusalem. How much aid and how often would they normally deliver?
The World Food Programme has been delivering now for more than a year assistance into northern Gaza, and we are providing mostly hot meals. We are running 6 bakeries until recently, and as well, we are providing direct food parcels to population in the northern of Gaza.
And that is to feed, what, the entire population of 400,000?
No, we actually have programmes that are run by UNRWA as well as the World Food Programme. And with the both of us, we actually are covering the vast majority of the population throughout the strip, but also in the northern of Gaza.
So is UNRWA having similar problems to the WFP?
It's actually all the partners, the humanitarian partners that are currently working in northern Gaza. The two crossings, which actually are the lifeline of the population, as there's no commercial good getting into the area, have been now closed since the 1st of October.
So for nearly 2 weeks now, the residents of northern Gaza have not been receiving aid from multiple agencies.
Correct. And the biggest challenge is that is the assistance getting in. We still had a number of our own warehouses with the cooperating partners that we have in the area. So we manage actually are relying on our existing stocks, but we are running short. Just to give you an idea, the only good that managed to come in was on Thursday, and it was fuel, allowing us to actually still keep up and running 4 bakeries in Gaza City. All the 2 left bakeries that we had in Jabalia and northern Gaza have been now stopped due also to the ongoing conflict. But if we have no more fuel coming in 2 days, the rest of the bakeries will actually have to be stopped.
Now, you're not going into northern Gaza because it's too dangerous, or you're not being allowed to go in by the Israel Defense Forces?
We are still asking as the World Food Programme and the various actors to get in, but currently any of our mission has been denied for our own staff as the World Food Programme to get in. The only cargo that managed to get in was fuel, and that was on Thursday. We hope that fuel will be able still to come in, otherwise we'll have to shut down the rest of the bakeries. This is the only fresh food that is in northern Gaza. For the time being, there were practically no fruits, no vegetables for months that entering into northern Gaza.
So what are you hearing about the impact on the population of these dwindling food supplies?
I was still there until the 8th of October. A daily for a kid is actually to queue to access simply water, potentially bread, and then to have a hot meal. That's what's currently happening. People are just desperate just to get on with just basic food items.
I mean, again, I'm just wondering at what point those basic food supplies will no longer be available in any form to the residents of northern Gaza.
It is really a matter of, I would say, a week, maximum 2 weeks. After that, there will be no food in the area.
Are people leaving northern Gaza in large numbers?
From the information that we've gathered is that there are very few that currently have left. Most of the population are only moving within the northern part of the Gaza Strip.
It was Antoine Renard, the WFP director for Palestine. Well, the suspicion among Palestinians, the UN and relief agencies, is that the IDF is gradually adopting some, or all, of a new strategy in northern Gaza known as the General's Plan. At its heart is the idea that Israel can force the surrender of Hamas and its leader, Yahya Sinwar, by increasing the pressure on the entire population of the north. The plan was first devised by a group of retired senior officers led by Major General Giora Eland, himself retired, who is a former national security advisor. Early he explained why he thought this strategy would work.
Hamas manages to continue and maintain their effective political control of the Gaza Strip. And it happens for the simple reason. Every day there are about 300 trucks of supply that enter Gaza. And Hamas is the main player that is delivering this supply. So it's perceived by the population as the legitimate entity, or more than that, the group that is taking care for the people. Since Hamas gets all this supply for free, but they resell it in a very exaggerated price, they become richer and richer. And the fact that they are so rich today enabled them not only to maintain the existing administrations that consist of tens of thousands of employees, but they can easily hire new combatants to replace those who have been killed because they can offer them a very nice salary. Hamas feels quite comfortable, especially the leader, Yahya Sinwar, because as long as the political control of Gaza is in his hands, and as long as the people of Gaza gets all the supply, he has no real incentive to give up anything, and especially not to give up the 100 Israeli hostages that are still in captivity.
How do you therefore defeat Hamas?
The only thing that might bother Sinwar today is a loss of land. So Israel is actually encircled. The northern part of Gaza that contains something like 35-40% of the whole area of the Gaza Strip, we do it since November. So what we have to do is actually to execute a real effective siege over this area. Now, in this area, there are about 300,000 civilians. So before we exercise a real siege and prevent any supply of goods to this area, we should give all the people who live there early warning and tell them that they have to leave in, let's say, a week or 10 days. And after that, we will stop all the supply to this area. So those combatants and other officials of Hamas that choose to stay will have to decide whether they are going to surrender or they will starve. And if it happens and when it happens, it means that we can easily take control of all this area. Now, why it is important? Because when we take control, practically speaking, occupy all this area, we will tell Sinwar, actually we have to tell them in advance, that if there is no reasonable hostages deal, and if in few months all the hostages will be dead, then he will never see this land and this area will be taken out of Gaza.
This is a strategy that you and former military colleagues came up with, and I wondered whether it was being implemented either in full or in part in northern Gaza by the IDF at the moment.
At the moment, I cannot see that the full plan is going to be implemented. It is true that there is a massive ground operation north of part of Gaza, and it is true that the IDF is calling to people there to leave this area, but their critical element is missing. And the critical element in our plan is a real formal announcement that says that within certain period of time, no supply will enter this area. So those who want to survive must leave, otherwise they will have to face a real terrible possible starvation.
I mean, there hasn't been an announcement, but as you're doubtless aware, the World Food Programme say they haven't been able to get aid into northern Gaza for nearly 2 weeks now.
Yes, that's exactly the element that is missing.
Can you understand why civilians might be reluctant to leave, even if they are told to? They might never be allowed to come back.
Well, this is one of the reasons. Of course, Hamas is trying to prevent them from leaving.
Over the past 13 months, it does seem as if the Israeli authorities have used food as a weapon of war in Gaza.
That's simply not true. I thought that we should have done it, but it has not been adopted. On the contrary.
But it's been a constant debate.
There is no a debate about that. What is happening in Gaza is that Hamas sent a message as if we were preventing food from the population. And this message has arrived in Washington, in New York, in London, in other places, and created some reaction. But none of them were based on any real facts. So Israel did not use this tool, although we should have.
That was a retired Israeli Major General Giora Eland. Spanish scientists say they've settled the uncertainty over the final resting place of Christopher Columbus, the explorer who opened the Americas for European conquest. They use new DNA technology to compare the remains in his tomb in Seville Cathedral to known relatives, confirming they are genuine. Very shortly, the scientists will reveal another finding on the origins of Columbus, who's traditionally thought to have been from the Italian city of Genoa. I spoke to our Madrid correspondent, Guy Hedgeco. Why were there ever any doubts about where Christopher Columbus was buried?
Well, the doubt is simply because of the fact that his past is relatively shadowy. We don't know every detail about his biography. So there's this long-standing theory that he was born in Genoa. We know that he died in the northern Spanish city of Valladolid in 1506. But between those two facts, we don't know if indeed he was born in Genoa, and we don't know that either. But between those two facts, we don't know a great deal about his biography. And so there's been a lot of mystery surrounding Columbus for decades, and historians have argued over whether those remains in Seville were actually his. And they've also, of course, argued over where he was, in fact, born as well.
Is it known why he was buried in Spain?
Well, you have to take into account the fact that we do know that he was backed by the Spanish crown when he crossed the Atlantic in 1492 and reached America. So he was, if nothing else, an adopted Spaniard. But of course, that doesn't mean he was born in Spain. But it made sense, therefore, according to many, that he should be buried in Seville, in a Spanish city, seeing as he'd received the backing of the Spanish crown, which was so crucial, especially the financial backing for that voyage across to America. So in that sense, it did make sense that he was buried there. But there was this competing claim from the Dominican Republic, which has said all along that it has the remains of Columbus in a mausoleum in Santo Domingo.
So we might know where Columbus was born, where he actually came from, and a lot of competing claims about that, and indeed over Columbus's ethnicity.
Yes, that's right. I mean, there have been dozens of claims over the years about where he was from, including that he was from Poland, Scotland, Hungary, Nordic countries. But these researchers have whittled down the possibilities to a short list of eight. And those eight possible places are in Spain and Portugal and Italy. One of the theories is that he was, in fact, Jewish, and that he kept that quiet because of the religious Catholic fervency of the Spanish crown at the time. That's one theory. There are other theories that he was from Galicia, northwestern Spain, from Mallorca.
That was our Madrid correspondent, Guy Hedgeco. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Marshall, and this is NewsHour. Next week, the British Parliament begins a process that could change fundamentally the law under which people in this country live. Should it be lawful to help someone to die who's asked for your help to do it? The most senior Catholic clergyman in England and Wales, Cardinal Vincent Nicholls, is this weekend urging Catholics to write to their MPs to oppose assisted dying ahead of Parliament's debate on the legislation. Let's hear from some of the BBC's audience who've written to us about this story. Our team has voiced up comments from listeners Valerie, Ruth and First Donal.
My mother died in 1999 at the age of 94, having spent the final 4 to 5 years of her life in a nursing home. She was doubly incontinent and either in a severe depression or suffering from dementia. She hardly spoke to me over those years, even though I visited her about 3 times a week. She was a woman who loved her privacy, and the loss of dignity must have been a dagger to her heart. Once, when she did speak, she said, "We live too long." I'm now in my 80s, and that phrase resonates on a daily basis. I've instructed my family to try, if at all possible, to spare me this kind of ending. I dread the thought of getting a stroke or similar illness, which may prevent me from making the decision which I undoubtedly would make, that is, to bow out with dignity when I've had enough.
It was heartbreaking to me with my beloved dad and mum, as he had a lingering death at our hospital. He was 49. We believe in the sanctity of life. I would not have dreamed of wanting to help him end his life. We are Christians and know that God has promised to give grace to help in a time of need, which he did. It really concerns me that those who feel they are a burden to their loved ones could request all treatment to be stopped if this bill becomes law.
I am 90 with arthritic pain. I have survived breast cancer and I lead a busy life. But my greatest fear is to die painfully and without dignity or control. Assisted dying would relieve me of my worst anxiety. My friends agree, palliative care is not adequate. As a retired lawyer, I am convinced that proper safeguards can be put in place.
The view of Valerie, and before her we heard from Ruth and Donal. Well, my colleague Sean Lay has been speaking to Cardinal Vincent Nicholls, the Catholic Archbishop of Westminster, and asked why he'd written what's known as a pastoral letter, one which will be read out when Catholics go to church on Sunday.
I would like to try and achieve 3 things. One, genuinely invite people to think quite seriously about this issue, which actually touches on very, very fundamental truths and fundamental relationships between us all. Secondly, I'd like them to take part in discussions in their own home, with their friends, wherever. And thirdly, I would like them to express their views to their MP. I think it's very important that MPs don't just listen to the lobbies, but genuinely listen not just to the opinion polls, but to give attention to what people think in their quieter, more reflective moments.
There is some opinion polling to suggest that Catholics are perhaps more willing to contemplate changing their view on this than the church hierarchy is. Opinium, the pollster commissioned by the campaign group Dignity in Dying, suggested that 69% of all Christians and 65% of Catholics in Great Britain would back a change in the law. That was some survey work done in February of this year.
I would want to say that an opinion poll does not surface a really considered opinion or view, because an opinion poll is always framed in a certain way, in this case by those who are shaping it with their point of view, and it asks for a quick answer. And what I want is for this to be not about quick answers, but to be about serious consideration. So there are three points that I would like people to think about. The first, be careful what you wish for, because the general experience in other countries, not exclusively the general experience, is that the availability of bringing to an end another person's life goes wider and wider and wider. So that you get, in Holland, a teenager who's anorexic can access the right to be killed or to kill himself. So be careful what you wish for. Secondly, the right to die can quite quickly become a duty to die because pressure begins to mount. You see, a law which prohibits something acts as a real deterrent, but a law which permits something actually changes the whole atmosphere. And what is permitted is then seen to be good, and maybe you should think about doing it yourself. The third thing is that what challenges this puts before the medical profession. In a phrase, the duty to care can become a duty to kill.
I just want to be clear about what you're saying, because on the one hand, you're saying you want people to engage in a debate with their families and with their friends, and also to address their MPs, which will be a form of lobbying on their individual behalf, perhaps rather than collectively. But nonetheless, it is to try and influence opinion, to bring in their perspective. But in your pastoral letter, you said assisted dying is, quote, a story better not begun. You can't have it both ways, can you?
Well, no, I beg your pardon. I mean, people are determined to begin the story, and so therefore we have to engage with it. I still think it's a story better not begun, or as one of the correspondents today writes, a line better not crossed.
Well, we've already crossed. I'm sorry to interrupt, but I want to be clear on this. Have we not already crossed that line? Because only a matter of years ago, the then director of public prosecutions, who now happens to be our prime minister, that's coincidence because it was a different role he was in back then, but issued guidance on this very question, suggesting there were circumstances where the state would not choose to prosecute someone who helps another to die, even though it was apparently an absolute prohibition in law. So I'm not clear why you say the story cannot begin. It has begun.
Well, I mean, the question in front of us, as you know, is a question of the framing of the law. The law is the framework within which we relate to each other. And I believe if this law becomes permitted, passed, then inevitably at times we will look at each other in a different way. We will look at each other and think, oh, I wonder if this doctor really had something else in mind. I wonder whether my children are looking at me in my old age in a slightly different way. Because a law which permits very quickly becomes a law which encourages.
That was about senior Catholic clergymen in England and Wales, Cardinal Vincent Nichols, the Catholic Archbishop of Westminster, speaking to my colleague Sean Lay. And that's it from this edition of NewsHour, from me, Julian Marshall, and the rest of the team in London. Goodbye.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at America's relationship with China.
Diplomacy between the world's two largest economies remains characteristically choppy. But could the result of the U.S. presidential election unlock a calmer future? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.